Hello, this is Alan Chartok, and today we'll be discussing climate change with Dr. Art DiGaetano, professor and associate chair of the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Cornell University. Dr. DiGaetano's research centers mainly on the impacts and adaptations that result from climate change. Dr. DiGaetano has been at Cornell since 1991, initially serving as the research climatologist for the federally supported Northeast Regional Climate Center, NRCC. He now directs the NRCC. The NRCC is one of the six federal centers that produce climate data, data products, and decision tools to regional stakeholders. In addition, he teaches classes in meteorology and climate change. Art serves as climate editor for the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society and is an associate editor for the Journal of Applied Meteorology and Climatology. Prior to his arrival at Cornell, Dr. DiGaetano was an assistant professor with the meteorology department at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology in Rapid City. DiGaetano received his bachelor's degree, master's degree, and doctorate in applied climatology from Rutgers University. Welcome, Dr. DiGaetano. It's a pleasure to have you here. I know how valuable your time is, and we really appreciate your being here.
My pleasure, Alan. Looking forward to talking to you.
Well, let's start by asking the crucial question. There seem to be what we call deniers out there, people who say, it ain't so. There is no climate change problems in the world. Are these people being irresponsible?
Oh, I don't know if they're being irresponsible or not. I guess in some ways they are. I think they just fail to look at all of the data, all of the information, and in some ways might be a little bit uncomfortable, a little bit uneasy with, you know, the solutions to the problem.
We can go in 1,000 different directions, but let's try this one. What are some of the solutions to the problem?
Well, I think what we see for the most part is the climate change we've seen, the anthropogenic climate change, is largely due to the increase in greenhouse gases that we see in the Earth's atmosphere.
The National Climate Center reported that the first 8 months of 2012 were the hottest ever. What does that mean?
Well, that's just a continuation of the trend that we've seen over the last decade, actually since about 1998. Many of the years within the last 12 or so years have been the record. We keep getting these records year in and year out. So this isn't the first time we've seen a news release like this come out of the National Climatic Data Center.
So is it our fault?
Is it our fault? I guess it's cumulatively our fault. I think, you know, early on when we started burning fossil fuels, we didn't quite know the consequence. But as time has gone on and research has shown that there are very good reasons to believe both theoretically and in looking at the data why the temperature should rise and we should see the changes that we've seen in the atmosphere and in the climate record, I think as we let that go on and on and on, we do become irresponsible.
What does this all portend for the way that we live? I've seen some data that you guys have produced that say summer in New York could feel like a summer in South Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, there's any number of changes that we will see. Clearly, life, society as we know it today will change with the changing climate. We'll see the sea level rise. A lot of our coastal cities, a lot of our infrastructure, a lot of our population are in areas that are just marginally above sea level. Now, I think one of the most graphic examples is that when you tell people that the temperature will warm by, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 degrees over the next 20, 30, 40 years, in a lot of cases, particularly if you live in upstate New York, you say, great, bring it on. I like it, especially if that's in winter. But I think it is a dramatic example when you say that the climate of New York will become like the Carolinas or like Georgia. I think that clearly we perceive the differences in climate across that geographical range.
Well, you sound like a very considered, moderate man, but is this something that is akin to when Superman's father put him on the rocket to the Earth because they had destroyed their own?
I don't know if I'd go down that road. I think basically the two keys to this is we have to learn to not only adapt to climate change, even if we stopped emitting greenhouse gases today, we're locked into a certain amount of,
sure,
of climate change. The world, the climate system has, for lack of a better word, inertia, kind of like, you know, stepping on the brakes on a Big Mac truck. You still go for a while before they grab. We'll see that in the warming. We'll see the atmosphere continue to warm. We'll see the oceans continue to warm, again, even if we stopped emitting greenhouse gases today. The other side to that coin is we have to learn to become less dependent upon fossil fuels or look at ways that we can keep our same energy demand but without adding the greenhouse gases to the atmosphere.
So is it too late?
I don't think it's too late. As time goes on, it approaches that point. I'm an optimist, so I hate to say it's ever too late. It's probably too late if we expect to see, ecosystems, a world, a climate like we've become accustomed to.
So I take it Al Gore in An Inconvenient Truth was when he showed us those pictures of water coming up over Battery Park and all the rest of it. He's right.
He is. Any number of the projections or models we see for climate change shows that part of New York City to be particularly vulnerable, not only to the rise in sea level itself, but any types of surges you might get with winter storms coming up the coast or hurricanes coming up the coast.
So if we live in the northeast of the United States, what practically does all of this mean to us? How bad will it get?
Well, I think if we look at the northeast, the largest impacts are clearly going to be sea level rise.
Sure.
There again, we see very good theory, very good evidence to show that, ocean levels are going to rise and, rise on the order of feet by the end of the century. The other thing we're obviously going to note is the changes in air temperature, particularly in winter. Days below freezing will become few and far between. It's not to say that it won't snow, but when it snows, the snow cover will be less persistent. That actually means dramatic changes to the ecosystems that we're used to in the Northeast. Systems that have basically evolved to take advantage of the snow cover. We see things like more invasive species survive the winter, things that normally don't survive in New York or the Northeast because it's too cold.
For example?
Will start to take a foothold. Yeah. Different weed species. Kudzu is a good example. Kudzu is a noxious weed to the south. Pictures you may have seen just, old cars or trees or telephone poles in encased in this vine-like weed. That's something that we've seen moving northward. Ticks, Lyme disease ticks is another possibility, different mosquito species, different
Nile.
Agricultural pest. West Nile, not so much in terms of winter temperatures so much. I mean, I think that species of mosquito is here, and I think the phenomena that we see here is actually more maybe an early spring, summer phenomena in terms of that virus replicating and also the survivability of those mosquitoes. Most of them don't typically overwinter.
If you own a ski business right now, would you sell your stock?
I don't know if I'd sell my stock quite yet. Again, there's a good example of adaptation. I mean, if we look down the East Coast, there are viable ski areas in the Carolinas, in Virginia, and places like that. So maybe in the near term, I'd be looking in investing in more snowmaking equipment. I might be looking to diversify myself and maybe have something there to bring in some income in the summertime. I don't think I'd, again, being the optimist, I don't think I'd hang up the stock or the skis quite yet.
What about, let me ask you this. My parents had a place on Fire Island, Barrier Beach, in front of Long Island, and they always said, if Fire Island disappeared, Long Island would be in great danger. In other words, there'd be no more Great South Bay, the Atlantic would go over Fire Island, and then it could hit Long Island, there could be devastation. What do you think?
Well, I guess I'm not saying that that Fire Island is going to go away, but that's very clearly the case. The barrier islands do exactly that. They protect the mainland from the ocean and the tidal surges that come in due to the storms that affect that region.
Huh. We're hearing a great deal about hydrofracking, particularly from your colleagues at Cornell. Are there any dangers that, that we can relate to climate change?
Yeah, I don't think the process of hydrofracking itself relates very much to climate change. Where it does relate is the fact that we're hydrofracking for natural gas. So if we look at the greenhouse gas potential, how much carbon goes into the atmosphere from burning natural gas as a fuel source as opposed to burning, say, an alternative like coal, there are some issues there.
Now, what about vegetation, things like the great hemlocks? Will we see a change in what grows and what doesn't grow?
Sure, we'll definitely see a change in the landscape, not only the native species that grow in the Northeast, but also many of our cultivated agricultural crops. In terms of hemlock and spruce, I mean, these typically tend to be forest species that like colder climates. We see the spruce forest, to a certain degree, the hemlocks in cooler areas. So things like the spruce forest in the Adirondacks, keep getting pushed further and further and further up in elevation to take advantage of the colder temperatures, and eventually those cold temperatures go away. So we see a change in the makeup of the forest. I believe the hemlocks, on the other hand, aren't quite as cold-loving. I think we see them further south, if I'm not mistaken. But there a problem, again, is with these invasive species. We can, you know, the hemlocks have been compromised by an invasive pest called the hemlock woolly adelgid. And that's one of those species that do better in warmer conditions, so we're likely to see increased pressure from that pest in the hemlock species.
So you seem pretty calm and collected, Dr. DiGaetano, as opposed to, you know, the kind of hysteria that we often hear connected with this subject. Is that because you just want to be professorial, or are you underneath really worried about this, about your children, about the rest of it?
I guess a little bit of both. You know, in some ways, I don't think the alarmist approach is the right approach to have people take action and understand the gravity of the situation. Nonetheless, underneath, you know, I do see the types of changes that are projected. I myself have projected some of those changes, and sure. I see a world that's very, very different. I'm not necessarily saying in my lifetime or my children's lifetime or hopefully even my grandchildren's lifetime that we're talking about the end of civilization or anything like that, but we are talking about a very different world. We're talking about you know, parts of the world where there are very large populations, and those areas may be overrun by the sea, and those people will become immigrants and refugees. And you know, I just see a very different world, and a lot of the problems and things instigated by climate.
And there will be natural repercussions from all of this. I mean, if you tell people you're going to lose your homes, you got to move, you got to go up the hill, there'll be somebody else living up the hill. So that could create certain social disorder.
Sure, there'll be other people living there. You say up the hill, but it may be from one country to the next. So there mm-hmm. you even kind of escalate the scale of the problem. You know, some of the things we see today even is people are reluctant to leave their homes. In some ways, I don't blame them. I think I would be too. But if we, you know, don't have to look too far across New York to find places that have been flooded, sure. have had record floods in the last few years, but yet we continue to build in those areas and things along those lines. So that's one way we can adapt, is we can realize that these types of areas become more and more vulnerable to flooding as climate change continues to play out.
So really, how grave is this?
How grave is this? Giving me a tough question here. Like I said before, I don't think it's the end all, but it is clearly a problem that society has not dealt with. It's a problem that I don't think society is well prepared to deal with. And what I worry about in some ways is how rapid the problem plays out. You know, we've seen the climate change before. It's changed many, many times before. You know, one of the arguments I often hear is, well, you know, back in the medieval warm period, the Vikings had farms on Greenland, and, you know, there's a period of time when the earth was warmer and things just worked out fine. Yeah. But I think you have to realize there that those past changes were very, very slow and very, very subtle. They occurred over, you know, many, many hundreds of years. And what we are seeing now, anthropogenic change, is occurring over the matter of decades.
You say anthropogenic. That's a word not everybody is familiar with. Can you give us
sure.
some insight into it?
Anthropogenic, essentially man-made, human-caused.
Yeah. Okay. So the rate of change is something you just talked about. So is it geometric? Is it arithmetic? I mean, is that what you're worried about, that we don't even know how fast it will go?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I mean, you know, we look at the change in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and that has definitely occurred exponentially. We're now emitting upwards of 7 gigatons of carbon in the atmosphere each year, gigaton meaning a billion. If we look out 100 years, the best projections, or if we keep on the course that we're at, we're due to quadruple that. So, you know, the amount that carbon dioxide has increased in the atmosphere has been staggering. What we see with temperature in the climate system is, you know, things tend to lag in the climate system. And probably the best example that I can give you is, even though, you know, the longest day of the year is toward the end of June, and the sun is the thing that warms the earth the most, you know, we typically don't see the hottest days of the year until the end of July or maybe August. Mm. So again, a lag in the system from the maximum heating in New York to when we realize the warmest temperatures. If I use an Ithaca example, if I wanted to go swimming in Cayuga Lake, my chances are best that the water would be warmest probably around this time of year. Again, a lag in the system from the atmosphere to the ocean. So we see something similar to that with climate change, where, you know, for the most part, over the last few years or the last couple of decades, when CO2 has been increasing dramatically in the atmosphere, the temperature hasn't been responding at quite that rate. It's been going up. If we look at New York, for an example, we're looking about a degree and a half Fahrenheit over the last, you know, 30 or 40 years. But really where we expect to see that kind of really start to take off is within the next few decades.
So if Barack Obama called you on the phone and said, Professor DiCaetano, I know your work. We are in the middle of an emergency right here. I'm calling you in and I'm going to give you extraordinary powers to do anything you like right now in order to avoid this. What would you do?
Yeah, I don't think that's a fair question because how's that for an answer, huh? I think one of the reasons why it even goes back to starting off, you start talking about deniers and skeptics and
things like that.
It's a multifaceted problem. If I were an alarmist or kind of just put on my climate blinders, I would say, well, we have to stop emitting greenhouse gases today.
Right.
We have to prepare for whatever changes we're going to see in the climate system over the next several decades, the changes that are already locked into the system, and no ifs, ands, or buts about it. But then I do realize, looking back, how dependent society in general is on fossil fuels, how our economy depends on that, and I can go on and on and on. So, you know, I think one of the problems is there's clearly not a quick fix. It's not something that you can flip a switch overnight. But yet, you know, we have to be looking towards that. We have to be looking towards alternative energies. We have to be looking at perhaps ways that we become less dependent on fossil fuels, but, you know, still maintain, the economy growing and things along those lines. That's what makes it a really tough problem.
So are we committing suicide?
Are we committing suicide? I think suicide is too strong of a word. I think we're not keeping our house tidy, I guess. And if you can imagine, the more and more you don't keep your house tidy, the worse and worse it gets, the bigger the problems you have. You know, it might start just that it doesn't smell too good, and then you might end up with vermin and other diseases and things like that. So it's kind of a snowballing effect, if that analogy makes sense to you.
So you mentioned not too far from Cornell, from where we're speaking to you now, there's a region of our state which really almost, in some cases, small towns almost got wiped out. Isn't this alarming? Do you think it's just anecdotal, a once every 500-year storm, or do you think that, in fact, this is where we are?
I think that should be the wake-up message. In the past, we could say, yeah, maybe a once in 500-year storm, these things happen. But we've clearly been seeing these things happen much and much, much, much more frequently, particularly in the Northeast. I would say one of the things that has changed the most in the Northeast over the last 40 or 50 years has been the increase in extreme rainfall events. You know, we see a lot more greater than 2-inch rainfall events than we have seen in the past.
Now, I understand this, a not yet released version of a guidance document will be incorporated into the next U.S. National Climate Change Assessment that will be released next year. How about giving us a look into that?
Sure. I mean, by Congress, probably since the early 90s, the U.S. has been supposed to be releasing these climate assessments. I believe it's once every 4 years. It's kind of dropped off there for a period of time after the Clinton administration. The latest one is due out next year, and, you know, basically, it's going to show a lot of the things that we've just talked about. You know, for the Northeast, it's going to highlight increases in temperature, particularly increases in temperature in the wintertime. It's going to highlight dramatic decreases in snow cover and snowpack, of which many ecosystems and like you alluded to earlier, recreational or small towns in upstate New York rely on that as their main source of income. It's going to show increases in disease pressure on plants and agricultural crops. It's going to highlight quite a bit changes in extreme rainfall, again, in the Northeast. If we look at any spot in the country, the Northeast sticks out like a sore thumb in terms of the increase in heavy rainfall event, almost a 75% increase in heavy rainfall since the 1970s.
So this is a worldwide problem. If we do something about it, California, New York City, how much of an impact can that have if China keeps building more cars?
It's clearly a worldwide problem. You're absolutely right. us alone, we alone aren't going to solve the problem. I forget the exact figure, but I think if we look at just the northeast region of the U.S., New York and the New England states, New Jersey, I think thrown in there as well, you know, we're in the top 10 or 20 in terms of carbon emissions, and that's, you know, out of countries. Sure. So, you know, we emit much more greenhouse gas into the atmosphere than the vast majorities of countries in the world do. If we look at our current per capita emissions, it's by far greater than any place else in the world. But you're absolutely right. You know, other countries in parts of the developing world want to see economic growth that depends on fossil fuels. And, you know, a big question is, what does China do? What does India do? You know, we see some evidence that perhaps they're concerned about climate change, too. They're concerned about maybe the impacts of climate change. But much like us, they're headed down the road where they're putting their dependence on fossil fuels ahead of some of those things.
We're talking with Dr. Art DiGaetano, professor and associate chair of the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Cornell University. So there was Kyoto. We said we're not signing. Was that a mistake?
I don't think it was necessarily a mistake. I don't think Kyoto did enough in terms of cutting emissions. I think there were some probably political and economic reasons not to sign Kyoto. However, I do think signing Kyoto would have sent a message to the world that we view this as a problem and we're willing to work with the rest of the world to find a solution.
But instead, it may get interpreted as you guys are just greedy and now you're telling us what not to do.
I guess you could take it that way.
Right. Because if I'm some small country, as you just mentioned, and I'm trying to build up my industrial capacity and the rest of it, and I turn around and I say, hey, wait a second now, what are you preaching to me about? You know, you guys won't even sign the most basic, and Dr. DiGaetano says that, it didn't go far enough, and you won't even sign that.
I agree. It's a tough political dilemma, and I guess that's why I'm a physical scientist and not a political scientist.
But clearly, you recognize the political implications of this. Unless decisions are made, we're done for in the long run.
I agree. And I mean, that's where we need to work together with the rest of the world to find a solution to that. And I mean, part of the solution may not be denying these small countries their ability to develop their economies, develop their society like we have over the last 100 or so years. But perhaps there are ways that, that can happen while not emitting fossil fuels at the rates that we have, looking at changes in efficiencies, looking at alternative energy sources. Those are the ways that we have to move. And I mean, also, to be frank, we can look at societies that have similar standards of living as the United States, but yet by far lower per capita emissions of greenhouse gases.
You know, everybody who talks about this problem talks about alternative energy sources. I just bought a Prius. I'm very proud of it. I use less gas. Nevertheless, I'm sort of fascinated by the reaction by many of the conservatives in the country who say, it's all foo-foo stuff. It's not ever going to be enough. You know, we've got to keep on drill, baby, drill, and we've got to keep on doing this stuff. I mean, how do you answer that?
I mean, I think to a certain degree that's true. I mean, I think really what I'm talking about is not kind of going cold turkey off of fossil fuels and switching to some other source of energy, solar or wind. But really where I think that, you know, looking at the problems of climate change and things like that, what we have to do is probably look for a portfolio of energy sources, you know, kind of like your 401k plan or something like that, not just rely exclusively on one source of energy, but have a whole portfolio of energy resources.
You know, there's a lot of talk about these auction systems. How does that work and how does that help?
Yeah, I mean, basically what an auction system does is it's a way of basically limiting the amount of greenhouse gases that are emitted by a certain region. So if we, let's say, New York as our region, basically the idea here is that one can say over the next 20 years, I want to reduce my greenhouse gas emissions by X amount. Mm-hmm. Basically, you look at your main emitters of greenhouse gases, say a power plant, and you can say, okay, guys, over the next 20 years, this is or actually even shorter than that, per year, this is the amount of greenhouse gases I want emitted from within the state borders. You basically have to buy a chit, and you can emit this many tons and your competitor can emit this many tons based on how many chits they buy at the auction.
Yeah, but it seems to me, I've never quite understood how this, I mean, the rich get richer. You've got a ton of resources and money in a particular area. And you say, okay, we're going to buy some of your chits from you and we'll continue to pollute because we have more money.
In some ways, that's how it might work if you are one utility, but keeping in mind that the overall emissions are capped at a certain amount. So even though it's there, that's potentially possible to do, I guess.
Well, I don't see why it wouldn't be. I mean, I see apartments in New York City going for $17 million now. Somebody's got $17 million.
I guess so.
Okay. So what will it take is the question to scare the hell out of people. In other words, a tsunami coming off Long Island, more Prattsvilles in which one not so strong storm sweeps away small villages and towns. I mean, what is it that will achieve the change?
Yeah, I think just seeing more and more and more of these impacts, more and more of these flooding events that basically wipe out whole towns. You know, you look at the literature and the interest in climate change, you know, Katrina-like hurricanes, the flooding events of New York. Actually, even a lot of just the events we've kind of seen in this past year, a very, very warm winter, unprecedented temperatures in the middle and late parts of March, an untimely freeze because the fruit crop was so far advanced from being so warm all through the winter, and a very warm and droughty summer. I think as time goes on and we see more and more of these impacts and actually have to deal with the impacts, kind of see the in some ways economic tolls of these impacts, that's the thing, at least in my mind, that'll make people at least start to get the message that this is clearly a problem and a problem that affects them.
So when you speak of the early warming and then the quick freeze and then the apple buds, you know, go and people have to pay more for apples, but aren't those almost always explained as just sort of freaks of nature? You know, in other words, that they don't add up to a system. They're just something that just happened one time.
Yeah, I would very much agree with you. That's the way it was in the past. And I think the best analogy that I can think of is actually baseball. And if we, you know, have hitting a home run as being that freak occurrence or something like that, you know, it was an unusual occurrence. But as time went on and players start taking steroids, they start hitting more and more and more home runs. So if we look at any one home run, you know, we can't say, oh, well, that was that... you know, would he have hit that anyway if he didn't take the steroids? Because obviously people hit home runs when they didn't take steroids. Or say, oh, he hit that home run because he was on steroids. So we have to look at it's the frequency of these things. We see, you know, any one home run is not due to the steroids, but the number of home runs that we might see in a season is due to the steroids. So we can look at that in climate change. That's, again, one of these floods might not be that big of a deal, and we can say freak of nature. But when we see these occurring time and time again, the frequency increases. That to me should be the signal.
So, Dr. DiGaetano, let's take New Orleans as an example. You know, you see Katrina, and everybody says, holy moly, this is terrible. We all raise money for it. And then a couple of years later, you know, once in 1,000 years, once in 500 years, a couple of years later, a very simple little tiny hurricane, which loses a lot of its power, goes, and still the floods come. Can you talk about New Orleans for a moment?
I guess I don't know all that much about New Orleans specifically. You know, it's clear that each hurricane is different in its characteristics. I think what made Isaac problematic in that area is its persistence. It parked out just off the coast, just off the Gulf Coast, and therefore, you know, put down lots and lots of rain day in and day out.
But why did it park?
Good question. You know, again, I don't think I would point to that as being necessarily something we would expect under climate change, but it did park and cause those impacts.
What's it like to be a professor or the leading professor who is expected to save us from ourselves?
I don't know about the leading professor who's expected to save us from ourselves. Some days it's a daunting task. It's difficult to, I guess, speak to audiences and you know, have them hear what you're saying, but yet then perhaps not see them take action. I wish maybe I was more of a motivational speaker in some cases. I think in some ways I maintain my optimism is because I do look at the students that I teach, and I do get a sense from them that they are definitely concerned about the problem, and I also think more willing to be to contribute to a solution to the problem.
And how do they do that?
I have seen them become more and more conscious about efficiency and conservation of energy and that type of stuff. I see them more engaged in things on campus, looking at alternative fuels and things along those lines. I see them more politically active than perhaps I was at that age.
You ever look down at an ant colony on your land and see all those little ants scurrying around and then someday say, hey, we're them?
I don't know where you're going with that.
I'm not going anywhere. I mean, I just have to think that, you know, we have this society. We look at the ants and say, aren't they stupid running around doing that stuff and the rest of it? And yet we're running around basically creating a hell here on Earth.
Yeah. I mean, I think really what it boils down to is so we have to realize that the solution to the problem isn't going to be easy. The solution to the problem is going to require us to, change the lifestyle that we have become accustomed to. And I think change of that magnitude is often scary, you know, going into it.
So there are some leaders. Mike Bloomberg is one of them, has commissioned studies of all of this stuff, and some people who are willing to put their money into it. But is what we're facing a problem with our political leadership? I hear a hesitancy on your part, so let me just go a little further. So we have an Al Gore who, after he loses the presidency for one reason or another, you know, gets interested in this and gets a prize for it. Some other professor types coming along and saying, repent or you're done for. But in the end, this is the kind of thing that takes sort of long-range planning and needs political leadership.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe as you were saying that, I had a little bit of time to collect my thoughts. I think where perhaps the political leadership is at fault is in some ways I see them sort of advancing or propagating the skepticism. I mean, if we look at the scientific community, there is by far consensus that increasing greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is responsible for climate change, is responsible for a warming of the climate. You know, where and if skepticism comes in scientifically, perhaps, is in the degree of warming. So is it going to be 2 degrees or 5 degrees or 7 degrees? And having been around the science for, you know, many, many years, you know, in grad school pretty much before, you know, climate change or global warming was even a, you know, a mainstream term, you know, I've seen scientists who have gone from sheer denier that, we can't put enough carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to matter. You know, I've seen them come around to change their stance as time gone on to say, well, yes, this is going to happen, but, oh, it's not going to be as bad as some scientists say. When I look in the political arena, however, you know, I see some, you know, some politicians saying, this is just not going to happen. The science isn't there. The scientists don't know what they're talking about. I think there, if we really want to solve the problem, we need to embrace the best available science, and that science is worldwide, basically. It's not just coming from U.S. scientists, and say, hey, we have a problem here. The solution ain't going to be easy, but, you know, we need to work toward it.
Help me with something, Dr. Di Gaetano. What does the word science mean again?
What does the word science mean? So, I mean, I guess where you're going with that is we question the unknown, basically.
But doesn't science, by its very nature, have a predictive quality to it? And I am going somewhere. You know, I may as well announce my agenda. And that is, if science explores the unknown and therefore becomes a predictor of phenomena, you know, E equals MC squared.
Sure.
And if the science community can put its head together and say, this is the way that it is now, and unless we change, we are in some ways doomed. If the scientists with all of their predictable nature can do any of this, and there is a political class in this country for whatever reasons, I happen to think they're self-serving. I happen to think that, you know, they don't want to put anything on industry and any or on wealth acquisition so that they're in the other side of things. In other words, they're going to say, ah, those scientists. And they do. They do it all the time. Ah, those scientists. They don't know what
they're talking
about.
I've heard that before.
Yeah. They don't know what they're talking about. That's a crisis in terms of our listening to those who know more than we do.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to listen to both sides, and I think I've tried to
well, you don't
say
want to listen
that
to,
earlier on.
Yeah, but you don't want to listen to idiots who just want more money in their pockets. You want to listen to the people who have studied it and who know it. You say, we have to listen to both sides. Why should we listen to both sides?
I think we have to listen to both sides is, as a climate scientist, I can't say that the only thing that matters is climate. You know, if we're looking out 100 years from now, the only thing that matters is that we have a climate that looks like it did today or 50 years ago. I realize there are other things that depend on that and also have to change. Economics, economic growth, for example, or things like that. But it's a matter of striking the balance between those two things. It's a matter of getting that's where the leaders really come in to say, all right, look, we have this scientific problem, climate change. Well, we also want economic growth. We also want security of our borders. So is there going to be immigration problems? Are we going to be fighting wars over water and things like that? All of these problems have to be kind of dealt with, not each in isolation, but as everything together.
So let me try to push you on this. You're much smarter than I am, but I don't understand. If we discovered that a pill could stop cancer, but it would cost a fortune to make that pill, should we say we have to listen to the other side because economically it's just not feasible? Or should we say we just have to have some kind of a plan that will create a different paradigm?
Again, I mean, I see where you're going with that. I think you'd have to weigh all of those things together. If you had a miracle pill that would stop cancer, you know, again, if I'm looking out for myself, I'd say, bring it on, give me that pill. Or if I was looking out for somebody in my family. But looking at the big picture, again, I'd have to say there, I don't know if in that hypothetical situation to get rid of everything else, to spend all the money on getting the people these pills, if that's the right answer or not. You know, if it's not the cancer that's going to get them, it's going to be something else. So I think I'd really look at that, again, factoring all that stuff in.
Huh. So when the seas rise, what happens? In other words, what happens to the seas themselves?
Most of the sea level rise that we've seen thus far and in the near-term future is actually nothing more than the volume of seawater expanding as it gets warmer. So as things warm, they expand. So the same thing happens to the water in the ocean. So basically, it's a thermal expansion of the seawater. As time goes on beyond the short-term future, we start to see water being added to the ocean as the ice sheets that are currently sitting on land, Greenland and Antarctica, basically start to melt and dump their water into the ocean basins.
Now, Dr. DiGaetano, has that happened before? I mean, do we know, based on what we're now seeing under that ice, that something like this has happened before and that we've then had a whole bunch of new ice put on top of that? Can we tell that?
We've seen that happen actually many times before in the natural cycle of ice ages. So we see some of our projections or kind of upper limits on the amount of change we see in the ocean are based on those past periods of time where the ice has melted or accumulated as we've gone through ice age cycles. Keeping in mind that really we're at a point here where the amount of ice in the ice age cycle on the globe is actually fairly low. So in other words, you know, if we were at the height of an ice age and I was sitting under the ice sheets here in Ithaca, sea levels would be a lot lower than they are today because all of that water would be locked up in the ice that's over my head.
And how much do we need that ice?
How much do we need that ice? Not exactly sure what you're asking. Clearly, we
Me
need
neither.
That number one.
Yeah.
You know, we've developed our society and our infrastructure over the last couple of hundred years based on where the sea levels are. And the sea levels are where they are today because that water is locked up on the land in Greenland and Antarctica. So we've built all our infrastructure. Society has basically, you know, most of the population of the world is within areas of the coast that would be flooded if those ice sheets were to melt.
What causes the ice ages to come back?
The ice age is due to basically changes in the Earth's orbit around the sun. So slight changes in how the Earth is tilted toward the sun and how close or near the Earth is to the sun. Basically, those changes occur to the gravitational pull of all the planets. It's important to say that that's the thing that starts the ice age. It's the trigger to the ice age. But what we see after that, why it gets so cold and why the ice sheets grow, is to a process that scientists call a feedback. So we make it a little bit colder, and that adds more ice, that adds more snow to the system. That additional ice and snow reflect more sunlight, and when you reflect the sunlight, it's not available to warm the Earth, so the Earth gets colder, and that process continues.
So are we able to project the next coming ice age if we don't screw it up?
Yeah, at least a lot of the people that I've talked to that study these types of things kind of suggest that we're at a point where we might not see the next ice age because of the amount of carbon dioxide we've added to the atmosphere. Ice ages have occurred pretty regularly on about 100,000-year cycles for the last 500,000 years. So on that scale, you know, we should be due for one. But there are people who argue in the literature that as we continue to increase greenhouse gases to the levels that we have today, it's going to become less and less likely that we would see another ice age.
Could the argument be made that by polluting our air and putting all that CO2 up there, we may be, in fact, forestalling an even greater crisis, which is that we're all covered with ice?
I think what's the problem there is it's a mismatch in timing, basically. In other words, yeah, an ice age might be a problem in the next 1,000, 10,000 or more years, so we might be forestalling that problem, but we're creating a problem of similar, if not greater, magnitude within the next 100 years.
So give us a little bit of a tour, if you will, Doctor, about how much CO2 is up there and what changes, if we make them, can make that difference.
So the current concentration of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere today is about 390 parts per million. In the past, during interglacials, the kind of pre-industrial CO2 level in the atmosphere is typically 280 parts per million is the number that's given. If we look at current projections for CO2 in the atmosphere, kind of continue to do what we're doing today, we're looking at CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere on the order of 600, 700 parts per million.
So how much, then, would we have to do to make a positive difference?
We would have to curtail our greenhouse gas emissions substantially, reducing our greenhouse gas emissions by mid-century on the order of 80%.
Do you see any way in which that's realistic?
Not without a lot of teamwork and cooperation or some technological advance that we don't know about yet.
So I hate to push you this way, but are we doomed?
Again, I think doomed is too strong of a word. I think what we have to do is we have to come to grips that we're going to have a very, very different society in terms of climate unless we take action.
Well, I like the way
action to both adapt and cut our greenhouse gas emissions. It's, you know, are we doomed? I guess it depends upon your definition of doomed. You know, we can use an analogy for greenhouse gas emissions, just like perhaps overeating or something like that. Mm. You know, I may gain weight and gain weight and gain weight, and am I doomed? Well, I you know, might survive to 50 or 60 or 70, or I might not. And you might turn that around to say, well, you could drop dead of a heart attack tomorrow. But what I'm doing is by doing that, by overeating, by increasing my weight, I'm increasing my odds that I'm quote unquote doomed.
So this is sociological, if you think about it. I mean, I know that you may not be political and you may not be sociological, but in effect, this is cause and effect. You see that if we don't reduce our CO2 by 80%, and we see there ain't no way that's going to happen, the results are catastrophic.
To a certain degree, I agree with you there. I mean, I see, as a scientist, I see the writing on the wall in terms of, you know, what the changes will be if we keep increasing the greenhouse gas concentration in the atmosphere. where I guess it is frustrating is, again, on the other side, as a climate scientist, other than to say we need to stop releasing greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and I realize the solution is more complex to that. You know, I don't know what the solution is, or I don't know what the best approach to meeting that solution might be.
Do you ever wake up in the middle of the night between sleep number one, as they're calling it, and sleep number two, and say, oh, God, this is terrible. I've got to save this world.
Occasionally, yes. There are days like that.
And so you give up and go back to sleep or what?
No, I guess not give up and go back to sleep. I mean, again, it is a matter of, you know, doing what you can do as, you know, stressing it in class, teaching it in class, getting students interested in that, giving talks like this, you know, quite a bit. I could pretty much quit my day job and be on a speaking tour, I think, if it paid as well as my job. Things along those lines. I mean, also kind of leading by example and doing the types of things that, you know, you kind of preach to the choir in terms of conserving energy, you know, reducing the miles you drive. Okay, I carpool to work with two other people, that kind of stuff.
But I'm just struck by how little we are doing to save ourselves.
I have to agree with you 100%. You don't hear it raised or very little raised in the current political debates. You know, it's in some ways...
Why is that?
How come they're discouraging.
How come they're not talking about it?
I think they're afraid of the other repercussions. You know, there are other issues, other problems that, at least on the national scope, are above climate change. Whether they should be or not, or whether they are totally independent of it or not, is probably another hour-long session to talk about. But if we're in an economic downturn and the economy is driven by productivity and productivity is driven by releasing fossil fuels, I can see, at least from that side of the thing, why it's not being brought up. But to deny it's a problem and to deny that it's not something that we have to think about in the whole context of things, I think that's being short-sighted.
So as a fellow professor, let me ask you, nobody else is listening, nobody cares, but let me ask you this. Do you think that that we are too separated in terms of our disciplines to come up with a solution based on what everybody has to do? It's like the doctors. You got one guy who looks at your lungs and one guy who looks at your back and one guy looks at your kidney, and they all sort of shrug when you mention the other thing. Are you frustrated by the fact that we have separated ourselves out into disciplines, which because that we can't be as one, that we have created a mess?
I think to a certain degree, yes. I mean, however, at least over my career as a professor, I've seen that basically the walls between the disciplines maybe not get totally knocked down, but definitely get significantly lowered. I mean, I know in my day-to-day work, and it might be just the type of work that I do.
And it may be Cornell.
Actually, I know it's Cornell, actually, that, you know, we are encouraged to work together with the disciplines. I even look at the number of faculty here at Cornell that do work in climate change, and it basically spans the departments. I can pretty much work with a colleague in economics or sociology or even history or something like that to kind of address, you know, at least from an academic point of view, address these problems. Where I think the barriers are still up and still high, it's really not, you know, in a lot of these issues, it's not necessarily the scientists that, you know, the scientists can present the science and present the facts, so to speak, but then it's up to others to kind of do something with it, be it industry or be it the politicians or be it whomever. And maybe there it's a little bit more where it's the barriers between the disciplines or the, I hate to say it, but the interests maybe are a little bit higher.
Well, we're just about out of time. Our guest has been Dr. Art DiGaetano, professor and associate chair of the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Cornell University. Thank you so much for joining us, all of you. And thank you, doctor. It's been a splendid hour. I appreciate your grappling with all of this for us. It's just great. And I hope you'll come back again sometime.
All right. Thank you very much, Alan. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alan Chartok.
been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.